morning. On to our next keynote. I'm Doug Mitchelson, the media analyst at Deutsche Bank. Very pleased to have Jay Rasulo, Chief Financial Officer of Disney. Thank you very much for coming, Jay.
Pleasure.
So, as you all know, Disney had an analyst day recently and also just reported the quarter. So it was very kind of Jay to come down. And I think rather than do sort of a normal run-through of each of the segments, we'll try to peel the onion back on a few different things that might not have been covered at the analyst day. But I did want to start off sort of generally with strategy. So as we sit here today, you think about execution in calendar 2011, you think about what you're working on the next 12 to 18 months. What's the best opportunity for management at this point to position the company better for the future or to continue to position the company well for the future?
Well, I think if you think about it at the highest level, we really are a company that is about creating high-quality branded content, particularly branded content that has franchise potential for us. And seeding those under our five major brands, Disney, Disney Pixar, Marvel, ESPN, and ABC. It is job one, two, and three. That content really fuels what makes our business model and our ecosystem unique, which is all of the business units taking franchisable content and using them in their appropriate spaces, bringing them to consumers everywhere that consumers are and want to consume that content, whether it's in the digital space, whether it's theatrically, in our theme parks, consumer products, and so on. Part and parcel with that, and probably becoming increasingly important, is seeding and using technology both to improve those products, but also to deliver those products in unique ways, trying to meet the ever-evolving trend among consumers and needs among consumers for portability, immediacy, platform agnosticism, and the use of technology and our embracing of technology as part of our business model is absolutely essential and something we spend a lot of time doing. Whether that is in the traditional space where technology is thought about, or even in our theme park business, where we've got to think about the fact that what worked in 1955, a sort of broadcast model for theme parks where you came and the experience was exactly the same, needs to evolve to sort of addressable individuals wandering around our parks that we can deliver specific experiences to. And lastly, we continue to focus. We don't talk as much about it. We probably didn't focus as much on it at our analyst conference, but the internationalization of our company. Like a lot of studios, the founding of our company was fundamentally as an exporter. That model, like I mentioned, the broadcast model in the theme parks, doesn't work anymore. You have to become not the Walt Disney Company in Japan or the Walt Disney Company in Europe, but a European version of the Walt Disney Company, a Japanese version of the Walt Disney Company, which means that we've got to deliver the same fundamental bits and pieces of that ecosystem that works so well for us here in the U.S. in each of the regions, and we have focused hard in the last couple of years in organizing around that as a principle, and are starting to execute, and it also means the generation of more local content.
So maybe we'll actually talk about those a little bit more in reverse order. So on the local side, I mean, do you end up having to put a lot of infrastructure in each individual market to try to make the Walt Disney Company in Japan, the Walt Disney Company in India, and so on?
It's not a matter of adding infrastructure. It is a matter of rejuggling. So historically, like a lot of U.S.-based companies and maybe a lot of foreign-based companies, we ran our businesses on a global line of business basis. So if you took consumer products or the studio, they basically ran, created a lot of product here domestically, and then sort of ran that organization right through the rest of the world. So it's taking those individuals, let's say in Europe, which is obviously a very big region for us, and reorganizing them around kind of a CEO of Walt Disney, the European Walt Disney Company, and having him manage those businesses in the same fashion that Bob kind of manages the entire company on a global basis. And so each of the business units and all of the individuals that work in Europe work for the head of the Walt Disney Company in Europe, and he gets to play those levers both on the content creation side, as well as on the sort of distribution side of global content, just as someone running the company here. So it's not additional people, it's kind of a reorganization of the people that are there. We started this model in very small markets to try. In fact, Poland was our first market in which one person ran all the lines of business. Then we expanded it to other small markets at the time, Latin American markets. Now we've kind of spread that model throughout the entire world.
So I guess if we take that, you know, through its course, I would think you'd have a much greater emphasis and more sort of capital money being spent on local production and ultimately sort of bulking up in distribution in those markets, whether it's sort of broadcast or cable networks or online,
yeah,
if that's cheaper and easier.
Yeah, and each market's quite different. I mean, the dynamics, whether it's from regulation or the maturity of the market for Disney, there is emphasis on different business units. If you look at India, for example, where they are sort of leapfrogging terrestrial television, leapfrogging cable television right to 3 and 4G, you know, that is a real opportunity for us to deliver content in a digital fashion. There's a lot of emphasis on what the potential for us would be there. It's also a market that does not have, any of you who know India, Western films are not big in India compared to Bollywood. In fact, the Disney name is not as well known as India as it is elsewhere around the world. So for us, it's very much a fledgling market and one that we're looking closely at the creation of locally based content. In other markets, the global content that we create in the U.S. works incredibly well. So we do need to create, if you will, less locally developed content. And it's a market-by-market situation. And we're looking at it fairly closely. If you look at China, which is also, you know, often considered right next to India, in China you can't, media won't be our foray into the market. Media is highly regulated. It, you know, for us to get landing rights for a Disney Channel, extremely difficult. So we're going in other, you know, other routes. Of course, you've heard about the conversations about the theme park there. Consumer Products has, I don't know, multi-thousand corners in stores. So we're trying to build our brand through different ways. So each market different, but each trying to utilize as many pieces of that sort of Disney ecosystem that that can be utilized.
Is it fair to you might have sort of answered that in terms of where the local production makes more sense, but versus your existing business today, when you look at this sort of local strategy, is there any region or countries that stand out where you say, okay, this strategy is really going to help that area the most? In other words, even though you might make more local content in India as a result of it working better there from Bollywood, could this strategy also still help, you know, Germany, Italy, Spain, France,
yeah,
as much?
I think it can. In fact, in the short run, I think the sheer size of those markets, the European market, the Japanese market for Disney, small increases in market share there can have very big short-run returns for us. And just the flexibility, adaptability, and speed of decision-making locally will definitely help us to increase our penetration there. I would say that, you know, the brick with a K, whatever you want to call it, that most people, you know, talk about as their long-term, their future internationally is a longer-term bet for us. They are markets that are, you know, small for us, under development. Even vast increases on a percentage basis are still small to the overall needle. But markets like Europe and Japan have real potential to grow, and I think this new way of thinking about managing there, and it's not that new. We've been doing it for about 18 months to 2 years, can really have great share gains for us in those markets.
I guess I probably know the answer to this question, but do you care to venture a guess as to how much international can grow as a percentage of the company?
I would say that I won't venture a guess where we'll wind up, but I would say that we are behind in our mix between international and domestic business. Part of it, you know, is a high-class problem. We've grown very rapidly in the U.S. Some of our businesses, by the way, if you look at our entire portfolio, and, you know, you're looking at the Walt Disney Company's, you know, total mix probably increasing from like 26% to 29% over the last year. But that mix is heavily weighted by ESPN, which, of course, does not have a big international presence, and by ABC, which has little to no international presence. And we are really focused. If you take those out, the mix between international and U.S. is much greater, but I think if you look at the number of children and the number of households coming into the middle class outside the U.S., real market changes where they can start to consume our product because of the youthfulness of the market, and can start to afford our product as, I think 30 million people a year move into the middle class in China. I think there's potential for someday the international piece to outstrip the U.S. in terms of the total size of Disney product.
Interesting. So let's get back to the first comment, high-growth franchises. One thing that struck me at the Analyst Day, you talked about sort of reducing the film slate to really focus on franchise properties. And you also mentioned that you still need to seed future franchises. And I'm trying to figure out if you're making enough films, if you're making enough TV shows, that you actually have enough R&D to create those next great franchises.
Here's the good news. We look at every... I'm not worried about that problem. The reason is that we look at every division of our company as a possible generator of franchises. And our history tells us that that's not a bad way to look at it. I mean, if you look at Pirates, which is, having its fourth franchise installment this summer, that started in the theme park business. We've got Club Penguin, which started in interactive. We've got, the Princesses as a franchise and Fairies as a franchise, which really started one in publishing and the other, the agglomeration of all the Princesses into a single franchise, was a consumer products idea. And then the Disney Channel, with upcoming with Phineas and Ferb. You've got Marvel with the Avengers with a new franchise. You've got Pixar, which is a franchise machine, coming out with Cars 2, continuing the growth of that franchise. We've got two new Pixar movies in the pipeline, coming out both in 2012. So I'm not too worried that we have the means by which we can continue to deliver properties with franchise potential. I think we invest heavily behind it. When you've got something like the Disney Channel, I think the Disney Channel's on in, 146 markets. Maybe that's the wrong, slightly off. But there's, producing both global content and local content, I think it is the opportunities for us to come upon something like Phineas and Ferb. I mean, who would have known when they developed that show that it is something that has real franchise potential for us? But we've got enough irons in the fire and enough people focused on it that I'm not worried that the pipeline is not being sufficiently fed.
On the Pixar side, the two movies in 2012, I think one is Monsters, Inc. 2.
Monsters 2, and Brave is the other one.
So, of course, we're always looking forward. We get nervous that, Toy Story 3 was fantastic. Cars 2 is likely to be terrific, so we always get nervous the next year can't quite live up to the prior.
Yeah, well, again, a different cut at a high-class problem. I mean, if Cars 2 is as successful as we think it will be, both for the studio and consumer products and its carry-ons, not too worried that we can't come up with something equally great. But, we run the company for the long term, and the success of each and everything that comes out of the pipeline is vital to us.
On the Marvel side, mm-hmm. I think you talked when the acquisition was announced regarding the ability to actually sort of build a boys channel globally, that you're very strong on girls, boys not quite as strong. So in terms of sort of high growth franchises, is there, how is that progressing
well,
on the Marvel side?
Of course, this summer we have, Captain America and Thor, both part and parcel. In fact, in a lot of the world, Captain America is being released as the first Avenger, Captain America, clearly leading up to what we think can be the first Disney-style Marvel franchise. I mean, Marvel has had great success with Spider-Man. I think we would recognize that Spider-Man is a franchise. There hasn't been a second Marvel franchise that we think. I mean, Iron Man, a couple of great movies, very happy with their success. Great character, great potential, also part of the Avengers. We, haven't been able to exploit what we do well at Disney, sort of this whole franchise management, but are leading up to that with these, with Iron Man and these two movies. So we're very excited about it. Of course, we did The Avengers kind of as a, you know, I don't know if it's a prequel, but as a precursor to the Avengers franchise, did an animated show on XD and continue to explore with our television group opportunities on the network and on Disney XD for you know, what we think will be another great franchise generator in the from the Marvel team. Excuse me.
And since we're on film and there's sort of a cross-section between using technology and the high-growth franchises, sort of continue along, there's a bunch of stuff happening in film. One thing that Bob said at the Analyst Day was interesting. He said the windows for movies are going to change dramatically over time. And I think that was, you know, potentially an obvious reflection of some of the things that are happening on the technology side. But is there any more sort of meat on the bone that you could put relative to that comment? You know, how do you think movie windows are going to change over time?
Well, I think, you know, the way we view it is that it is not, it's not a technology-driven phenomenon. It is a consumer-driven phenomenon that consumers are fundamentally wired for instant gratification, and technology and the existence or the emergence of technology is finally allowing them to express that. And when and what we've seen both in the U.S. and elsewhere around the world is that when you don't, when you aren't responsive to bringing product to market on a timely and well-priced basis for consumers when they want to consume it, they figure out how to get it anyway. And it's pirated, it's all over the internet, it's whatever. So when we step back and look at the windowing strategy, we're more in a mode of how do we get product to market on a timely basis but within a business model such that that re-windowing, if you will, is incremental to our core business and not cannibalizing other windows that precede it or follow it. And so we've been out there with a multitude of different ways of thinking about that. And sometimes we've gone with the industry, sometimes we've been first out, and sometimes we've rejected, you know, the direction that the industry has gone. If you look at the physical product, you know, the Netflix and Redbox kind of distribution, for instance, you know, of DVDs in the post-theatrical window, you know, the pricing just wasn't right in the business model for us to go out in 28 days at such an extreme discount. You know, we offered limited quantity of product on the street date at full price, and then recently Bob Chapek announced, the head of our distribution windowing, announced that we, you know, we're going to do 6 weeks, and we're going to do 6 weeks at $10 because that's, you know, a business model that makes sense for us. Now, we have an advantage where, you know, our films are more desired to be owned by people than others. We have a better sell through intention from people. They want to, you know, the economics for an individual of watching a movie over and over favors you know, sell through. But by the same token, you know, we're also looking at some of the other you know, windowing ideas that have come up. You know, premium home video window that is very early at a much higher price. We're looking at it all. I don't think that you know, one size fits all. I think that we've moved way beyond the point where you've got to pick your point on the demand curve. You've really got the opportunity to harvest different points on the demand curve, where the x-axis of the demand curve is, you know, is the time to the market, not quantity. And some people are willing to pay a lot of money for immediacy, and some people will never be willing to pay that, and they're going to be, you know, at the other end of the demand curve. We used to have to pick a point. Technology has now allowed us to be at multiple points along that curve, and I think that we are experimenting. Most of what we've done is very short term. We manage very carefully the, you know, and I'm drifting a little bit into the television side as well. We've managed very carefully the inventory that we've put out there, and I think that it's not crystal clear to anybody in the business, including us, where all these trends are heading, but I don't think we're going to roll back in terms of the desire of consumers to you know, express their own desire, both from a, you know, immediacy and price trade-off.
I mean, one window that hasn't changed virtually ever, I would say, would be the pay window, mm-hmm. Your contract with Starz. I would think that's one where you look out later this decade when that contract comes up, and regardless of how the relationship ends up with Starz, whether it continues or doesn't, I don't know that having your movies locked up from subscription services for the first 7 years of their life necessarily makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I don't know either. I don't want to, you know, predict where, you know, our deal with Starz goes out to 2015. When we did that, both on the sort of television side and with their partner on the streaming side, with Netflix, you know, we surveyed what was available to us at the time and what we thought the consequences would be, both from what we could take in and how it affected the other windows around us, and decided that that was the best option for us when we did that deal. 2015, we'll, you know, or sometime before, we'll obviously get the opportunity to look at that again and look at the state of the world that exists then and make the decision that's appropriate. I don't even want to guess what that might be.
The Disney All Access part that you've been talking about, where you essentially store the movies up in a cloud and, you know, people can get access to them directly from a Disney portal.
Yeah.
Am I thinking about that business right? This is a direct-to-consumer movie and TV show play for Disney?
Yeah, I was thinking of bringing Bob Chapek's cute little movie from the analyst conference, because it told so much about what Disney All Access was. It actually didn't say a thing. But let me try to tell you what it was that we're thinking about. We have been out there, you've all heard us talking about KeyChest for a while. And, you know, KeyChest is really a technology. It's a technology that allows sort of a platform agnosticism for the playback of Disney movies. And it, you know, it's inclusive of everything, you know, including ultraviolet and so on and so forth. We also had a loyalty program, you know, the Disney Movie Rewards program. We had, you know, a couple of other programs out there that have been, when they were introduced, time appropriate for what was available technologically. What Bob is doing is he's taking all of those programs and sort of uniting them into one thing where you can pull down your Disney content. You can buy it on any format, so you can buy it on the digital, you know, you can buy it in a box and it's with the digital copy and upload it. You can buy it digitally. You can no matter how it goes into the system, it can come out of the system equally flexibly in any format that you want to play it on. It is very consumer driven. It is sort of if you had to say, hey, I want to buy digital content, I'm afraid that, I don't know, if I buy it in standard def, you know, someday I'm going to want it in high def. If I buy it in Blu-ray, I can't play it today. This tries to take away any hesitation from people buying our media, because it kind of makes the promise implicitly and explicitly that, hey, whatever evolves technologically, you're going to be able to play, you're going to own and continue to be able to play the content on whatever device, you know, you decide that that you want to watch it on, whether it's a tablet, you know, in your car, in your home, on your computer. So I think it is, it's extremely obvious, I think, from the consumer side. The execution of it probably less obvious, but I think we are completely ready to get out there and start to express that. The timing of the actual launch of that product, I'm not 100% sure of. If you're going to ask, I don't know.
But it's a near-term event?
Yeah, near-term. I think it's this calendar year. I don't know. Lowell or Tammy can tell me. It's this calendar year, right? Yeah.
So then the other side of making your content more available and easier to access from the consumer is the concern that people will share passwords. What's your comfort level with piracy on these authentication-type services?
I think that we've crossed that bridge on the Time Warner, cable deal with ESPN, and you know they set up a format where there's enough opportunities for authentication that we think that the consumer is getting what they're buying with authentication. In other words, there's enough flexibility for authentication to be real, but technologically not enough flexibility for it to be like, you know, in India, where you get one subscriber to cable television and, you know, 10,000 families watching it. So we basically think that, look, authentication is a necessary step to the MVPD ecosystem. In fact, in some sense, what's happened technologically and what content owners like us have done to sort of get out and basically demonstrably say we want to get content in the hands of consumers in the way they want, has rung a bell that can't be unrung relative to the MVPDs. Now, don't get me wrong. We love the MVPD ecosystem. We have great partnerships with those distributors. We've had long relationships with them. We want them to continue to be enhanced, and authentication is certainly a way to do that. Needless to say, as a content provider, we want to be paid for that authentication and that convenience that gets delivered to customers. But at the same time, technology has to advance to protect exactly what I said and what you're worried about, that it becomes sort of the newest vehicle to piracy.
And I guess with All Access, we'll have even more sort of data on how that's going to work.
Right, exactly.
So the other distributor that you love is Walmart, and I know you have a pretty good relationship with them. How are they going to feel about you going direct to consumer with movie and TV shows?
Well, one of the principles that we've kind of addressed this changing marketplace and environment with has been, to maintain our own relationship with consumers. So Disney All Access is a good example. Similarly, whether it's the ABC player, ABC on iTunes, our relationship with Hulu, we want, to basically be out there in a world as a content provider where the more providers or distributors of that content to consumers that there are, the happier we are. And I think that every single one of those distributors, including Walmart, has an opportunity to have their own relationship with consumers. We want to be part of that, but we don't want to at the same time exclude ourselves. And we've been pretty determined not to exclude ourselves from ultimately, because we are a brand. Whether you look at our theme park business or something like Disney All Access, that our consumers feel a relationship with and feel very comfortable having a direct relationship with, and we don't want to cut that off.
I wanted to make sure we finished off the online discussion on the TV side. You already mentioned some of this at the Analyst Day and in some of the comments this morning. I think what I was interested in is you just cut a Netflix deal. They're paying a lot of money for television content. You gave them predominantly prior seasons or library shows. Given how much they're willing to pay, have you sold them everything that you're interested in selling them?
I think it's a. We view what's going on in that arena for us as still something where, hey, if we think we can sell them a product, it's not going to cannibalize anything else. It is truly incremental revenue. We want to be part of that. Have we plumbed the entire depths of our library in that deal? Absolutely not. Is there potentially other content? Maybe. But we saw a good deal of interest to us, of interest to them. It's fairly short term, as you know. It's a one-year deal. And thought it was a very smart thing for us to do. How that evolves down the road, I guess we all have to see.
So why don't we move over to cable networks? Obviously, biggest business. One of the things that investors are the most focused on is the NFL, difficult topic to talk about. But can you make any comments regarding what the impact might be if we lost some games or lost a season with the NFL?
Well, first of all, let me hurry to say that we hope that doesn't happen. All things being equal, we'd love to be broadcasting football on Monday nights. As is no news to anyone, the ratings of the NFL for the last 2 years have been outstanding, and it's been absolutely great programming for ESPN. Make no mistake about it. However, having said that, I don't want to get too much into the details of our deals with the MVPDs, but as we all know, due to the negotiation and the legal process, monies that we will continue to pay, even if there is a lockout for some part of the season, we will continue to pay. That's sort of a short-term cash flow issue for us. It won't be an OI issue. We won't expense those payments if the games aren't broadcast. And it won't have a value impact because we'll recoup the value with, you know, later with an extension of the time frame of our deal. But you know, on the, of course, the big question becomes in a dual revenue stream, what happens to advertising that would have occurred for those NFL games? And you know, not to pretend that we have a great crystal ball. The simple fact is that, you know, particularly, you know, at a time when we're seeing sort of an uptick in the economy, advertisers do want to get to the demographic. They like buying ESPN. They have been buying ESPN. They like getting to that demographic. And there's no reason to believe that because one piece of the programming goes away, they're not going to continue to try to get to that demographic. And by the way, that demographic is still going to be watching ESPN, if not NFL, something else. So I think that we feel like you know, we can weather it, and as much as we hope for first for the fans and secondly for ourselves that there isn't a disruption in the season, we don't think it'll be wildly disruptive to us.
And I've got a couple more ESPN questions, and just sort of, by the way, for edification, as you all know, I've been pretty bullish on the growth outlook for ESPN, so my questions are focused on what the potential negatives might be rather than the
positives.
There
are none, so let's move on.
The you know, Comcast now has NBC in the house. There's a sort of constant concern that they will go after the sports arena harder. Do you look at Comcast NBC as a potentially much bigger competitor than they have been in the past separately?
Well, I think, Doug, if you look at the sports landscape historically, whether it's been the networks on their own, now a network you know, combined with Comcast, it's been a competitive space for a long, long time. You know, the kinds of things that you write and the kinds of things that people read about the competition for sports rights has been a reality for us. I think ESPN, in its 31 years, has been masterful in basically making their way through a complicated landscape with lots of people willing to throw unbelievable amounts of money, you know, to gain packages, to buy sports rights. And I don't see either a fundamental change in our strategy or a fundamental change in the outcome from, you know, an additional competitor or a combined competitor, you know, entering the arena.
I know that there was some press about talking with the NFL about cutting an extension to the existing contract relatively early, and I think one of your ESPN spokesmen confirmed that there were talks going on. When you think about the potential for the NFL to carve out a second cable network package if they do go to 18 games or perhaps even if they don't, are there protections you can build into any extension that you do so that somebody else doesn't come along with a similar set of games at a much lower price?
I don't want to get into the you know, conversations that are going on. I don't think it's fair to the league and not fair to us to talk about, you know, things that are under discussion. But I can only reiterate that we feel like our position is strong. NFL is a great component in the brand ESPN. There are lots of other components that make up what ESPN is. The NFL is, you know, it's a package of 17 games, but it's much more than 17 games. It is 365-day-a-year programming for ESPN. It is expressed in a myriad of ways that are hard to mirror for other competitors, whether it's online, whether it's on radio, whether it's in our editorial shows. We really have a pretty formidable arsenal against whatever sports rights we buy, including the NFL. You know, needless to say, we're in a competitive environment. We're not really worried about that environment, you know, radically changing by either what the league might do or what other competitors might do.
All right, last sports question, I promise. Do you get worried at all about sports rights inflation relative to consumers' willingness to pay within the pay TV ecosystem? And what I mean by that is, you know, every cable and satellite company that wheeled through here this week highlighted sports costs as, you know, their biggest programming cost issue. In a lot of cases, it was the RSNs and not ESPN that was highlighted. But nevertheless, there's a point at which the consumer might balk at paying for increased sports fees. Do you worry about the health of the sports ecosystem at all?
Well, you know, obviously we've got to have our our ears to the ground on a couple of things as we execute our strategy for ESPN. First and foremost, are we continuing to buy a package of sports rights? And I don't mean the NFL package particularly, but the whole bundle of what turns out to be ESPN. Are we continuing to amass rights that make the ESPN network something people are going to want to watch, and something that's compelling and something that keeps the distance between our brand and the next brand in sports sufficiently far, sufficiently distant. On the flip side, at the end of the day, you obviously cannot ignore your consumer, and you've got to basically be sure that they are getting the value for what they are paying for, and that that you're not pricing whatever the service is, whether you're directly in control or not, out of their means. We don't think numbers of subscribers that we continue to retain and add to doesn't indicate that we're there. I wouldn't say we're worried about that today, but I'd say it's fair to say that in a market like any business where commodity prices are going up, you look at juggling your other cost levers to balance out the rise of a single commodity or some commodities. And for us, the interpretation of that is, as other sports package rights come up in the future, expire, and look for renewal, we've got to make sometimes tough decisions about what we do buy and what we don't buy. We've made those decisions before. There have been very attractive equities, if you will, offered, sports rights offered, that we simply had to end up walking away from because of the phenomenon that you're talking about. Would have loved to have had, would have expressed well across all of our platforms, but had to ultimately say, you know what, that will not work. We will not be able to balance that out, with something else. Because there is there's not only, by the way, the appetite of consumers to pay, but there's ultimately the appetite of advertisers, and there's at least so much advertising you can take beyond those shows. So it's a complicated calculus. 31 years of successful history of doing it well, gives me confidence that we can continue to do it well, and it's a reality of the business, I would say, more than a threat to the business.
So a question on consumer products, maybe one or two on theme parks, then we'll see if the audience has any questions on the consumer product side. Andy Mooney made a comment, I think in one of the annual trade shows, regarding potentially doubling licensing revenue over a 5 to 7 year period based on everything he was seeing.
Yeah.
That wasn't specifically mentioned at the analyst day, even though certainly he gave an optimistic presentation. Would you sign up for that Andy Mooney outlook?
Well, the good news is that I'm on record for not giving guidance. So I can say that every one of our executives has their own, way of expressing their enthusiasm and confidence. I think what Andy was mostly trying to say is that, and he repeated it much more explicitly, by the way, at that investor conference for those of you who are not there, that when you look at very successful brands and companies, and he used a couple as examples, they generally have gigantic market shares. So I think he threw up Coke and Nike and so on, and he threw up big numbers. I don't remember the numbers, but I think they were near the 50% level in terms of market penetration. And then he threw up sort of our numbers in the categories in which consumer products finds its biggest sales. And he said, hey, even if you look at successful categories for Disney, we are still very, very small in terms of our share of those markets and have incredible potential to grow, even though we're quite mature in consumer products. We've been doing it since 1928 or whatever. We still have enormous potential to grow in those markets. And I think it was the root of, some of the numbers that he's talked about in other presentations, which he didn't, talk about in that one. Suffice to say that we are all very bullish on consumer products. The experience we've had with Toy Story, the experience we've had with Cars, even in the intervening years when there hasn't been a film, the growth of the Princess franchise, the resiliency of the standard characters that continue to grow on an annual basis, close to 10%. We're just very excited about the continued potential of, actively working to to express our franchises in consumables in ways that are new and unique. And I think that his enthusiasm about that resulted in whatever he said, you said, I don't remember.
Theme parks, any update you could give us on trends? And as part of that, oil prices have been rising rapidly. What kind of impact would you anticipate on your business relative to that? Are there any concerns relative to that?
Yeah, I think that fuel prices, oil price. Let me take your second question first. Oil prices express themselves to us in two ways. One, as an input commodity to our business, and second, as an input cost to consumers as they think about vacation. On the second side, the more important side on the consumer side, historically, we have not seen increasing gasoline prices affect people's vacation decisions. It's just not enough of the it's not a big enough component in the total vacation decision for people to say, even though a lot of people still drive to Walt Disney World and Disneyland, it is not a big enough part of their vacation. And I think if you look more broadly, I used to be the chairman of the U.S. Travel Association. That is true broadly of travelers in the United States. Even folks who say they're taking car trips for their vacation, gasoline prices do not tend to discourage those car trips or shorten them. Availability of gasoline is a different story. When gasoline is unavailable, like it was back in the '70s, different story. But so long as it's available, the price, at least within the ranges that we've seen it historically and could imagine in the short term, don't think that's going to be a factor. On the cost input side, in the cruise business, fuel is probably the most significant business that we have impacted directly by fuel prices is our cruise business. We are not 100% hedged for the coming year, but we are hedged. I'm not that worried about it. It's a great high margin business. We've got a brand new ship that I said at the end of the first quarter or in our first quarter earnings report that we were in the 80s on the entire cruise line, notwithstanding the fact that we've added a huge piece of capacity to that business. It's a premium priced product even over our existing cruise ships, because 79% of the staterooms are veranda staterooms compared to like 23% our existing ships. Veranda staterooms get very high pricing compared to interior rooms. So don't think it's a big factor. Something, of course, we'll continue to watch.
And then any thoughts on park trends overall? Any update you can give us?
Oh, yeah. Since I wasn't going to answer it, I actually forgot the question. I really don't like to update in between. It just gets too much numbers out there, too many numbers out there. We said back when we did our second quarter earnings that at that time, our trends were booked 3% above the prior same quarter prior year. I don't want to update that. We'll see it again in May when we talk about earnings.
You've got a wide variety of pricing packages out there, especially with all the hotel rooms you have now.
So
it's hard to track for us, year over year, what's happening with difficult.
Someone tried once. Very difficult for you guys from the outside.
Let's call it difficult. So the relative to where you were prior to the downturn, can you give us a sense of how much are you still discounting relative to where you were prior to the downturn?
What we've said is that our fundamental strategy is to be on a trajectory to get back to what I would call normalized promotional pricing. There is always promotional pricing in our business. There's always shoulder periods, value periods, we call them, and peak periods, and we always price off of rack rate, which is the only way that one can really define discounting. We always price, as I'm sure the Breakers does and every other hotel that's ever existed. I don't want to give too much timing. We're not fully back to where we might have been sort of pre-downturn or at our peak, but we are on the trajectory to get back. We talked a little bit about that in our earnings in terms of ADRs and how we're booking. Fundamentally, it is our strategy. We haven't seen any problem in getting back on that trajectory. I'm not worried that we won't get back. And it's been sort of a steady climb. on the top line side, and on the cost side, you know, back during the downturn, we did do a big restructuring in the second quarter of 2009, where we fundamentally reorganized and restructured the administrative execution of our parks business, and took out costs that we don't expect to come back. So we're managing, you know, towards getting back to our pre-recession margin levels, and I don't see any structural reasons why we won't be able to get there. Now, I will say that in the short term, when I say the short term, I'm literally talking about this quarter and next quarter, you know, we've described some factors that will affect us, one being the $100 million of pension that I talked about, increased pension costs, most of which falls in the parks and resorts business because they have, you know, 70% of the employees of the company, but also, you know, startup costs for the cruise line, which didn't sail for 1 month of the quarter, but had all of the startup costs that one would assume in the quarter, a lot of new marketing, launch cost, launch event, press cruises and all that kind of stuff. As well as the beginning of the ramp up of startup costs for our Aulani Resort in Hawaii, which opens in August of this year. So, those factors will affect us in the second quarter. I don't see them as long-term inhibitors to us returning to pre-downturn margins, but they are some near-term factors.
Great. Any questions at all from the audience? We've got one up here. Tom, can you wait for the mic, please?
Thank you. Good morning. I'm curious about two topics. One is ABC, and the other is interactive video games. So on ABC, last week, Bob Iger was interviewed by Charlie Rose, and he talked a little bit about, really I call it changing how you're looking at the ABC business, how you're managing it, how you're measuring it. So is there a rethink going on in terms of ABC? What's the investment for that reinvestment for that new strategy going to be? And in terms of what you have in syndication right now, how many cookies are left in the cookie jar?
Okay. Talking about ABC. So I've unfortunately been in Europe and didn't see Bob's interview, but I will say that, you know, we view, everybody talks about ABC as the network and the distribution vehicle. And first and foremost, you know, we view ABC as a content creator. It is one of the potential creators of franchises for the company. You know, we had franchises on ABC like Grey's and Desperate Housewives that have been created and have created great value for the company through their windowing and around the world and really have been introduced into that ecosystem I always talk about we continue to look to that and continue to look to investing, behind the creation of those franchises. You know, the business has fundamentally become a two-stream business, like ESPN, both advertising and retransmission licensing fees. And it's a business that has some new leadership on the creative side. And that, new leadership always brings a new point of view into how to think about that. We've done a lot of restructuring on the news side. I don't know if Bob talked about that with Charlie, but and have really rethought, the delivery of news and how the infrastructure it takes to do that. And continue to, as I say, view it as a content creation vehicle in which we own the first window of distribution, and that first window of distribution gives you an advantage in launching new franchises, and that's how we see it and utilize it. Vis-a-vis syndication, look, syndication is lumpy by its nature, and it's lumpy in the same way that network ratings are lumpy. When network ratings are high, it means down the road you've got great domestic and international syndication. Those markets are both alive and well and continue to deliver return to great content. And when you've got a ratings decline or flat ratings you're not happy with on the network, somewhere down the road you're going to have a syndication pipeline that is a trickle and not a flood. So I don't know how else to describe. I don't know how else you describe the cookie aspect of it.
So to be clear on looking at the ABC, you're not looking at a significant step up in the investment in that business?
Look, I think that we want to create hit shows. There's absolutely no mistaking the fact that, you know, the network pipeline, the success of ABC needs to be fed by great shows. You know, we're just entering our pilot season. I'm sure that Paul Lee, who is who had great success, is doing exactly the same thing he's doing now with ABC Family. Did an outstanding job of understanding the customer for ABC Family, which, you know, turned out to be different from ABC, you know, more of a millennial market, and delivering programming that that, you know, became popular in that market, and he's looking to do the same thing at ABC. You know, all depends on what comes out of the pilot season and what they, you know, decide to pick up and invest in. So I don't want to predict that we're going to spend a lot more. Maybe Bob was more demonstrative.
Well, I wish you luck. And then on the interactive video game side, you're focused there throughout some pretty aggressive targets for the go forward from where we've been at. And we're all, for the most part, betting men and women in this room. I don't know if you're a betting man. What probability or how much are you willing to bet that they'll hit those targets?
I'm sorry, I missed what you were talking about. I missed the very first part of your question.
On interactive, where they gave guidance.
Interactive. I'm sorry. So interactive, look, I think that that we've done some smart things in interactive. First of all, we've come to realize that the game space and the dynamics of it are fundamentally different than what we're trying to accomplish in Disney Online. And we made the decision to split that between two executives because even though at some level of the stack, you know, I mean, let's call it the bottom of the stack, you know, it's all about bits and bytes, and they can share a lot of resources. As you get higher and higher in that stack, and you're now closer to, if you will, the consumer interface, the consumer experience, and what drives success in those two arenas, they're very different. So we ultimately decided to split the responsibility and give it to two new-to-Disney executives. Within the game side, I think that we were late in realizing the move from console, you know, fundamentally console-focused business to the much more casual and social game business that is absolutely on fire in terms of growth rates. If you look at the business, console is still a huge proportion of the spending in the business, but if you look at what the business will probably look like in 5 to 7 years, that is radically going to change. Console is not going to, you know, radically decline, but the other means of gaming, you know, social and casual and MMO and so on, are going to far outpace it in terms of growth. So we've refocused our energy from fundamentally console or heavily console into those others, and the acquisition of Playdom, you know, gets us into that social gaming space in a very big way. Sure, we could have probably done it organically over time, but I think we would have missed the cresting of it. We would have been way behind and looking at taillights for a long time. And the acquisition of Playdom got us solidly into that space, you know, with an executive who's lived in that space for most of his professional career. So if, you know, I guess if you, since you brought the betting analogy, if you're going to go to the track and bet on horses, you can either do what my wife does and say, I like pink, and that's how she chooses her horse, or you can read the racing form and look at who runs well in the mud and what their breeding is. We've done the former, or the latter. Former. Maybe we were doing the former. Now we're doing the latter. we've set ourselves up for success. That's all I can say. You know, when the bell rings and the gate opens, I'm not going to tell you where.
Those are comfortable baseline targets, the financial goals that
they have. You know, I think that their march to profitability, you know, is determined. They've set a goal for themselves, and you know, again, no. If you look at all the inputs, there's no reason to believe that they can't get there.
I think I'll take the last question. Back to choosing pink or choosing blue here. Dividends versus share purchases. The dividend has been in place for a long time. It's increased over time, relatively modest as a percent return. Share purchases obviously is something you're very active right now. You look out over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, and I know that you want to maintain, you know, what has been the most conservative balance sheet in media. Any sort of philosophy where you sort of look out 3, 5 years where you could see Disney more returning capital through dividends rather than share purchases?
Let me start by saying that when, you know, when we look at that decision per se, or more importantly, look at the big picture of what we do with our cash. You know, we really want to and believe that there are great opportunities for us to return, you know, have very high returns, either in continued investment in the businesses that we're in, you know, witness Cruise, the continued growth of DVC, all the stuff we've talked about, including the acquisition of Playdom and Marvel, things that we think have great return to shareholders, and it's really where we focus. When it's left to, you know, okay, in addition to that and allowing our investors to experience returns from the success of our company and the growth of our share price, we, you know, then look at, you know, direct returns of cash to capital and are pretty determined that, you know, we don't want to fall below the 1% yield we've been at. That's why we increased our dividend by 14% this year. And that you know, share buyback should be continue. We should continue to focus on share buyback at a minimum to be anti-dilutive to both option exercise within the company as well as the shares issued for potential acquisitions. So taking that as a baseline, I think you'll see movement around that depending on what other opportunities we have to use cash. We think our single A rating and our conservative balance sheet is a real strategic advantage to us. You know, during the downturn when everyone was afraid that they wouldn't have access to capital and started hoarding cash, we had access to capital. And it had to do with, you know, both the history of our balance sheet and the position that it was in. We've got lots of debt capacity. I think that, you know, we haven't been historically shy about using acquisition as a means of growing the company. We certainly look at it along with organic white space startup investment as both as, you know, viable vehicles for growing the company. Like both, you know, from the investor side, you know, the freedom that share repurchase allows investors, allows them to harvest, you know, returns as they wish, as opposed to, you know, a dividend, which kind of, you know, forces it to them and maintains flexibility for us as well. So we continue to look at that balance. I don't see, you know, in the near-term future that, that, you know, we start to, you know, wildly favor dividend over share price. But, you know, we certainly keep looking at it as, you know, as other companies do, I think, as markets change.
I had to have at least one financial question for the Chief Financial Officer. Thank you very much, Jay.
You're welcome. Thank you.